Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. Well, here's a question that I'd like to have you think about at least for a minute here while we get going. It's something we want to try to talk a little bit about in this part of the show. And it has to do with what it is we're looking for from the media, particularly what we're talking here about, the news media. And that's this. Do you think that the job of the media is to challenge what it is we believe about the world? Or do you think it's more about confirming what we believe about the world? Now, I think a lot of people would say what the ideal should be, in fact, that we want to be challenged. We want to at least be exposed to ideas other than those that we already have. But it seems that much of the time, what we're really looking for is, in fact, confirmation. Our guest for the program and this hour is David Tewksbury. He is Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Study in the Department of Communication here at the University of Illinois. He has spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about the news media. And I'm pleased that he could be here with us a little bit to talk about this. And questions, comments, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. You can tell us what you think. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And we also do have a toll-free line. So that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call us. We just ask people to try and be brief. So we can keep our brief in their comments so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
The kind of complaints about media bias are certainly not new. I'm sure that people have complained about editorial cast of things that they hear and read for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, though, having said that particularly maybe going back to the 80s, it has been more and more of an issue. People more and more talking about bias, particularly in what are generally referred to as the mainstream media, whatever it is you decide to consider the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And that it goes back perhaps to the time when there started to be an organized effort among conservatives to criticize what they thought were liberal tendencies in big news organizations, the big over-the-air broadcast networks and big newspapers like the New York Times. Mm-hmm. So having said that it's not exactly new, do you think, is there actually reason to believe that the degree of that, the number of people complaining about bias, the intensity of that of those complaints has in fact over time increased?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there are a couple of things that we can trace back that didn't start in the 80s that might have contributed, though, to this rise. There is decreasing trust in all institutions in America, from the news media to political institutions, even religious institutions. And this goes, you know, we can kind of take 1960 as our, you know, perfect era, right? It's kind of a typical thing that social scientists will do. We'll look back to the 1950s and 60s and say, well, since then, we've had declining trust in all these institutions. And so declining trust in the media then can just be part of this overall trend. And then you could argue then that that was going on. Then there were possibly shifts in the economics of the news business. The number of outlets available increased during the 1980s. The number of media options increased during the 1980s, started in the late 1970s. So where there maybe people were sort of seeing, not only am I not happy with institutions in general, but I'm now seeing more variety in the programming, whether it's entertainment or news. And you could argue then that people said, well, I'm not sure if I like this variety. I kind of liked it the way it was before, where it was relatively homogenous. Because one of the things we can talk about with respect to earlier than this is, and there's been some really interesting research on this, is the amazing homogenizing effect of broadcast television in the 1950s, 1960s, and the 1970s, where with its three networks, and yeah, they were different. You know, they had different guys, almost all guys on their news, but they're still relatively homogenous content. They basically gave us the same stuff. But as we had more options, and we have more options in the news environment as well as, of course, online in the 90s, but in cable in the 1980s and onward, that the more options kind of opened up people saying, well, wait a minute, maybe I can expect more. You know, maybe I can expect to hear my voice more often. Maybe I can expect to hear things that I agree with instead of what the journalists say is true. So it's possible this is where it's coming from as well. The opening up of choice, essentially let people imagine they could get something different, and so maybe some dissatisfaction. That's the most sort of generic way to look at it. As you said, there has been some research and some argument that it reflects, to borrow a phrase, kind of an apt phrase, I think, from Hillary Clinton, a vast right-wing conspiracy to think about, to discredit the news media when those news media are not agreeing with their candidate or with their political positions. That's possible. It's kind of hard to nail that one down. Researchers looking at this from the, through the 1980s and 1990s, looking at this particular charge in the context of elections, have argued relatively convincingly that you hear this charge most often when in a political context or in a campaign context when their candidate is doing badly. Don't hear it when their candidate is doing well. So it could be strategic. And it could be that this relatively strategic set of arguments has sort of gotten into the psyche of people, of general listeners who don't necessarily have an ideological sort of bone to pick with the media. Maybe they do after having received this kind of message quite a bit. It adds up then with our increasing cynicism, increasing distrust of these institutions. This could be where it's part of where it's coming from.
Yeah. Do you think that, that part of what is going on is the increasing presence and prominence, particularly in broadcast media, of people who clearly are doing commentary? They're expressing sometimes strongly and very loudly political opinion, so that we have Keith Olbermann and we have
Hannity
and Combs and people like that, so that we do have people now on both sides of the political spectrum.
Right.
And it's not that we've never had people like that in broadcast, because we certainly have, and sometimes even more intensely out on the edge than some of these guys, Bill O'Reilly and you know, people like that. But they seem to be – there seems to be more of them. They seem to be get a lot more attention, and the line between reporting and commentary has gotten kind of blurry.
Right.
How has that contributed, do you think?
That's a good question. It's hard to say what's reaction and what's cause in some of this, but I will observe that – or will say that observers of the media, people who've done content analyses, analyses of the media, have noted this tendency to do what is more traditionally called interpretive journalism, to interpret content as opposed to purely relay that content, that this has gotten prevalent in all the media over the last few decades, and it's increased in frequency. Again, researchers looking at presidential election campaigns noted that in the 1960s, 1970s, the vast majority of news stories that you'd find in a major newspaper like the New York Times were just purely descriptive, whereas today the majority of them are interpretive, where they're going to give a little description, but then they're going to talk about, no, what does this mean? So a candidate gives a speech, says he's in favor of some policy, and then but the rest of the article is, why? What's he trying to get out of this? And that kind of interpretation is not found just in the cable news programming, though, as you said, it's highly common, very, very common. But it really is, has become an increasing part of all of our journalism, much more of this interpretation.
So how do, you know, to the extent that you've thought about this and read about this and have a feeling about that, how do journalists think about that, because it seems to me that this is a departure from what has traditionally been the role, or at least what journalists used to have always said, that they're not in the business of making commentary. They're not in the, they're not supposed to be in the business of injecting their personal opinions. It's just the facts, ma'am. That is what we are supposed to be doing.
Right. Well, I will give what's probably not a popular response, which is that they that goal of objective journalism has always been impossible. It's objective journalism is, in my mind, is best thought of as a form that if you follow the form, the chances are greater that you will produce a balanced objective piece than if you don't follow the form, but it does not guarantee it. So what you could think of then is two sort of storytelling forms. The objective form, which is still the majority of news, I will say, in a lot of contexts, is the majority of news is the, you know, the inverted pyramid style, the usual stuff, which is the who, what, where, how, when, where. Did I get them all? Why? in the first few
paragraphs. All the W's?
Yeah, the W's and the H in the first few paragraphs. And then, of course, the two sides of every story, relying upon sources for truth, and so on. That those, that is one form. But that against that form is this is also, or in addition to that form, is the interpretive form, which is also old, which goes back to the early 1910s, 1920s, just as much as the objective form goes back to the late 19th century. They're almost as old as each other. And in the interpretive form, you sort of don't try to be neutral, but what you try to do is to say why. You know, you spend much more time on that. Well, this is why the journalist or why the president is doing this. This is why this event occurred. This is why we have this problem. And also try to project the future. So it's not so much the form, in my mind, which is really the issue, whether it's objective journalism or interpretive. It's what the journalist is trying to do. Is the journalist really trying to give you the truth? You can get there through either form. Or is the journalist really just trying to give you his opinion or her opinion, and without really any sort of nod to the truth? And I think that you can – it's best probably to evaluate journalists and news by that standard. What are they trying to do and what are their – how well have they achieved that than by the form.
Certainly in this country, there's a long tradition going back a long time, particularly in print, of – of having a very clear political agenda and political opinion.
Good point.
That is really obvious, so that if you would be reading a particular publication, you'd know perfectly well what their viewpoint was. So you wouldn't be surprised at what you would read there. And I think that now, in a similar way, you know, if you go out and you read the National Review or you read Mother Jones, you ought to know what it is you're going to get, because they have a clear kind of political orientation. And it seems that we don't, you know, you don't, I mean, maybe some people would not like things they read in the Wall Street Journal, but I don't know that you're really going to attack them for conservative bias. That's sort of like, well, okay.
Yeah.
It's like attacking the sky for being blue, you know? Well, yes, of course they're conservative. That's the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. I wonder though why it is that we, with some publications, we just say, well, that's the way they are. But that we're more inclined to, and maybe it is because they're the people who position themselves, who try to position themselves in more of a middle ground, and at least say what they're trying to do is give you an account. If we see something there that we think lean one's way or another, then those are the people we're really going to get on, as opposed to people who clearly do have an ideological viewpoint and they wear that on their sleeve and there's no doubt about where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I do think that's the case. We'll take, for example, and this is an easy one that people have done, but I'll throw it out, just to look at how European countries deal with the press, particularly, say, Britain, which has highly, as you said, highly ideologically sort of not skewed, but they have well-positioned or across the ideological spectrum of their newspapers and magazines. And you said, and there's no problem with this. I think that's probably the answer, which is they're used to it. And we're not so used to it. So if we're more used to these outlets who are sort of overtly ideological and make no bones about it, they're going to tell you news that they think is going to be conducive to their position. I think you're right. I think that if people were expected this, they'd have less of an issue. I think it's where people's expectations are of some, and I said before, really impossible goal of perfect neutrality. If their expectation is for that, I agree. They will be disappointed. And it's relatively easy to be disappointed in a lot of news outlets. I think it's a lot about expectations.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Tewksbury. He's an associate professor and director of graduate study in the Department of Communication here at the U of I. We're talking about news and bias in the news and perception of bias in the news, and perhaps also what it is people are looking for from the news media, what it is that they want. You can share your reflections on any and all of that. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. There is yet another kind of force in the news media that shapes content, and that is the fact that a lot of media outlets are in fact businesses, and they're in business to make money. It's a commercial operation, and certainly there are all kinds of things that can shape editorial content, but that's when I think that maybe we don't give that as much weight as it actually has, that the big networks and big magazines and newspapers and people who are in the business are there to make money, and that will influence their editorial orientation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you're raising a good point, which is I probably should have, you know, we should have talked about this a little earlier when we talked about this sort of rising accusations of sort of liberal bias. Well, there have been lots of very vocal critics criticizing the media for a conservative bias for a lot longer. They started this as soon as we had large commercial media organizations. There were people saying, wait a minute, this, by definition, these folks are going to be supporting the status quo, the economic status quo, because that supports their business models and so on. Mm-hmm. And so this has been a vocal criticism for a long time. But I think that what you're hitting on is really an important point, and that if we were to try to understand why we have the media outlets we have today, why do we have companies that are or news outlets that are relatively partisan, or at least we perceive them this way, and we should talk about perception a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But if we actually do this, it's because it makes good business. There's the reason that Fox is relatively conservative news, and we've got lots of evidence from this last campaign that they're far to the right, or at least to the right of the other cable news channels. But then it's also why MSNBC went left this year. And there's no question that they did. I mean, again, we've got some really startling data. I looked up over this morning showing that MSNBC their news coverage was substantially more critical of John McCain than the other cable channels, other networks, the broadcast networks and Fox. So that's not an accident. This is because it sells. It's the same reason why you have mainstream magazines, a few mainstream magazines, but you instead have thousands of magazines like Southern Bride and Pacific Diver. These are my two favorites. Extremely focused content on a particular, very focused audience. That's what makes money. And particularly over the last 20 or 30 years in the broadcast industries. So it's driven by economics. So what journalists, I think, are doing is they're trying to do the best job they can, knowing that their organization has a certain focus of what they're going to be doing, the kind of news they're going to cover, the topics they're going to cover, and also the ideological sort of bent they're going to have for their news. They're going to work within that environment to try to do the best they can to follow their ideals of good journalism, where at our school and lots of other good schools around the country teach these journalists what journalism is about. And they come away knowing what good journalism is. And then they go into the newsroom and spend their time trying to do that, trying to produce that. And usually I think they do a good job. So I think that economics do explain a large proportion of this.
We have a caller here we'll get to just right in a second, but just for a moment to talk a little bit more about the case of MSNBC. I think it's really interesting because for such a long time, the complaint by a lot of people, particularly people on the left, was it had to do with they saw within broadcast television and even to a greater extent in radio, to talk about talk radio, saying that if you look at the people around there, the people who are doing the commentary, they would say that they were all very, very conservative. And there wasn't a lot of liberal talk, and certainly in broadcast TV, it was from the center to the right. Mm-hmm. And it seemed that there was no other side of the coin to Fox.
Right.
And now it seems like at least there is some other side of the coin that's developing, and MSNBC seems to be leading the way. And it seemed to, from me and from what I saw and read, it seemed to start with the response to Keith Olbermann, who is a very, sort of a liberal commentator. He's like the anti-Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah.
And he did very well. Right. And I think the folks at MSNBC said, whoa, look at this. Look at what we got here. Right. And so now we have Rachel Maddow. Right. And, who knows where that will go. And I guess I particularly wonder, just at least from a business point of view, is that going – are more people will say, well, we know that you can make money if you have a conservative orientation. Will there be more people now who will say, looks like you can also make money if you have a – liberal orientation, and maybe we'll have more of that as well, and at least have a little bit more of each on both sides.
Well, we have two models to how to think about this. One is Stephen Colbert on the Comedy Central, right? He pretends to be a Bill O'Reilly sort of conservative, but clearly is lampooning that whole argument. So he's sort of a pretty strong left-leaning. So you could use him as one model, and he's been very successful. Mm-hmm. You also – then the other model is Air America, which is this liberal network launched a few years ago that's really just gone nowhere, and I don't even know if it exists. I think there are actually a few programs.
I think it still does exist, but they're just hanging – and this is on the radio. This is – they're just – if they do exist, they're hanging on by their fingernails.
Yeah. So that's an unsuccessful. So we don't – it's a little unclear how this is going to work out. But I think if taking the long view of how media evolve, it absolutely makes sense that media outlets, news outlets, will grow to fill these kinds of niches. I certainly think this is going to be the case. Mm-hmm. How successful there are, you know, will depend on the taste of the audience and how much the audience wants to be this focused and wants to be specialized. But just purely by historical model, yes, we'll have more and more of these. We'll have, you won't just have a left and a right. You'll have a couple different kind of lefts and a couple different kind of rights. I mean, it will break down if the patterns continue. And I don't know if we'll have these on TV. We may have these as we can think about the online environment as maybe being more conducive to that. But yeah, the economic models suggest that this will happen.
For programs like Colbert or for the Daily Show, which is where Colbert came from, as he's sort of spun off, although the programs have rather different personalities. And they're interesting for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons that they're interesting is that so many people, particularly young people, say that's where they're getting their news from, or that's where they're getting part of their news, or some of their understanding about what's going on. How do you place a program like that? Is that a news program? Is that an entertainment program? Or does that – would you be inclined to say that distinction maybe doesn't matter?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, academics are doing both of those things. They're arguing that it is, and some are arguing that it isn't. And then a third group, are saying, no, folks, you're tied in an old model. That in fact, news comes in lots of different places, and it's not tied to the half an hour evening news program. You know, we're dinosaurs, those of us who grew up with the evening news programs, right, on the networks. Mm-hmm. That model doesn't work anymore. And the best way to think about this, as in terms of the sort of this kind of mixing of entertainment and news, is to think about your average web page where you go to, say, Yahoo.com's web page. You go there and you go there for entertainment, you go there for information, you go to do a search, you go to buy things, but you also get the news. It's all part of the same thing. I believe the third, which is you really can't say it is or it isn't a news program. You can say it's a place where people get information. It's a place where people get information that they find useful, just as much as they're going to find useful information for political issues or other issues in lots of other places that we don't necessarily consider news. Hard copy or Entertainment Tonight. People have shown that these things actually tell people about politics, or at least about their external world in some way. Mm-hmm. And people are getting information from these places. So I think that it's becoming increasingly difficult to pigeonhole what's news and what's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some folks who are listening. Urbana is the first in line, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
And this is a really good subject because, news in itself has become so a commodity, and that, I don't know when it developed, and sure, even back in the newspaper age in the 19th century and the early 20th century, it was what sold. So it's what sells. And I think a lot of this, the Daily Show, I saw it from the very beginning when, I can't remember his name, the guy who did a night show, he did a late night show after David Letterman. But it sort of turned into a counter to the Bush propaganda machine, or the Republican propaganda machine. So how you get news now, like you're right about these Yahoo pages and stuff, and people select out, they say, well, what do you really like to, what do you want us to send you? Like the New York Times, well, what are you interested in, science, or we'll send you all the science headlines. So in a sense, you were talking earlier about objectivity, and I don't even know if that's, I think that's sort of an ideal, almost like a word that's like, you say, well, what is art? What is good writing, that sort of thing, or good literature? It's sort of like people select out what they think is objective, but it's sort of everything's from a subjective viewpoint. So you really, objectivity is really sort of an ideal, almost like, sort of something you can, everybody kind of knows what it is, but they really can't define it. So I think the Daily Show was an interesting, this last election, and prior to that, they would hammer away at the talking points of the administration or talking points of the Democrat, and they would sort of show how everybody would repeat this sort of mantra about, like, what happened in Iraq. Okay, everybody says the same thing. So in a sense, that is a service to people, but it's like anything else. You either turn it on or you turn it off. So I'm not even sure if news is becoming definable. It's almost like objectivity. It's what exactly is it anymore? Is it an infotainment? Is it hard news? Is it informative? I mean, do people really even care? Or is it just something you glance by when you... I read a lot of foreign press, and I watch a lot of this stuff. I have a little bit of time. I sort of sold my company years ago. But I just find this whole, it's like almost gamesmanship. I mean, Stephen Colbert, you know, you're right, he's a fake right-winger. But, I mean, it's fun to watch because he skews these people. And how much news is skewing? How much, I mean, when is it, when, what is really important anymore? I'd like you to talk about that. Thank you.
There's a lot there. You can take that on however you like.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually, you mentioned a couple things that we should probably talk about at some point today. But yeah, the first question, you know, what is news? I think we can talk, there are a couple different ways. One way to think about it is, what is it that people want? You know, what do people want the news? And, you know, do they know it when they see it? I think there are two of the points you're making. And yeah, I think that people do actually want the news. There have been a number of surveys done by social scientists, political scientists, and communication researchers asking, you know, people, you know, do you value the news? Do you think you have an obligation to pay attention to the news, you know, to public affairs news and so on? And the vast majority of people say, yes, I think that people should pay attention to the news. They'll even say, I think I should pay attention to the news. So people have an orientation toward the news as a useful thing. But they also, the interesting thing is they also will treat it as something that they don't necessarily, you know, sort of, they know they need it, but they don't necessarily want it. And a colleague of mine, Scott Althaus, is in the political science and communication departments with me, said that it's really a choice of, you know, spinach or dessert. You know, which one do you want? Do you want your cake? Do you want your spinach? And we know we need the spinach, but really we want the good stuff, the icing on the cake, the more entertaining stuff. But I do think people do want the news. They do understand that they need information about their environment to make good decisions, whether it's good economic decisions, whether it's good political decisions, social decisions, going to, you know, sending their kids to the schools. I mean, these are all things that people are interested in for sure. But how do they know what is news, and how do they know what to trust and what not to trust? A lot of it is habit, in my mind. They come up with what has worked for them in the past, and they stick with it. So people who have developed an orientation toward listening to whether it's WILL or News Gazette or watching WAND-TV, they've got a pattern, it works for them, and they're going to stick with it until something comes along to kind of shake them out of that. I think that's something we have seen quite a bit of this sort of longevity of a pattern once you do it. So they'll say, the news is what I get from, you know, WCIA-TV. You know, that's the news because it tells me what I need to know. So I think people have that kind of an orientation to what is news. I also think, though, that the spinach and cake idea, there was a really interesting study that shows that back when there were only three network television broadcasts, news broadcasts, all at, I think, 6 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone. I used to live in...
I think that's right.
Okay, it was 7 when I lived in LA.
It might have been 5:30.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Yeah. So when there was one time when all the news programs were on across the nation, they're all on essentially at the same time for everybody, people had no choice but to watch that. So even people who didn't really want the news got it anyhow because that was all that was on TV. And during this period, levels of knowledge increased. When we moved into this network broadcast period, people knew more about politics because there was nothing else on TV. They participated more in politics because there was nothing else on TV. So it has a lot to do with the selection out there to how much news they'll consume.
Well, I'm also thinking about your spinach cake and metaphor, and mm-hmm. and I'm sure that there are also people who would say, you know, those people saying back, you know, back in my day, when we watched Walter Cronkite or whoever, mm-hmm. then they would say that the difference between that time and this time is that the people who made those programs seem to feel some obligation about making sure people ate their spinach. And yeah. what they said is that here's your spinach, eat it, and gave it to you. And that the difference between that time and this time is that there's a much greater tendency of the media to say to people, oh, you want cake? Okay, here. We got it for you. Yeah. Have a second helping. And that somehow, and I'm sure that there are people who work in the big news organizations to say, no, Dave, come on. That's not true. We still think we have an important job to do here, and that we're contributing to civil society, and that we think people really need to know certain things, and we're going to give that to them. So, you know, that may be unfair, but I think that there's a little bit, you know, there's a whole lot, maybe what you say is true, is that there are a whole lot more opportunities for cake.
Right.
And if that's what you want,
go
to it. You know, yeah. You don't have to have the spinach.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a couple things we can point to as changing over time. And one is the relationship between the news part of the news business, the editorial part of the news business, and the money, the business part of the news business. And not in public stations, you know, like we're in now, but in the corporate stations, in the corporate TV stations, in the newspapers, and even in the magazines, Reporters will tell you that there is much less separation between the houses, as they say. The church and state, separation of church and state is how the journalists used to talk about it. There's much less separation where the editors are forced to think more about the business and less about what is good news and what is the right news to get out to folks. And this comes from weakening budgets. All of the news businesses are losing employees right and left. The newspapers are being hammered right now. They're laying off people right and left because the advertising dollars are going away. So they have to think just strategically, will their company survive? They have to think in terms of those sorts of things. And that's a shame. They shouldn't have to think about that. They should think about what are the important issues and how to cover those issues well. But they do have to think about this, and they're increasingly, as the corporate owners of the news media, particularly the broadcast networks and most of the newspapers, as they're owned by ever larger and larger organizations whose main business is less and less about the news, those pressures to produce profits, however they do it, whether it's by doing good news or the soft news, the entertaining news, those guys don't care. They just want to get the profits because the news organization is just a little bit of their massive enterprise. So I think that you can talk a little bit about the dumbing down of the news and the more infotainment. But I will say, and I definitely believe we have lots of evidence that both of those trends are there. Mm. But I will say that you're run-of-the-mill journalist, and I know many journalists from friends and people I've met on campus, and there are a few run-of-the-mill. They're all, I think, give every one of them gold stars and pat on the back for what they do. They know that they have a couple different things that they're up against. They have real, honest-to-gosh goals to produce good news, to produce news that's good for, and this sounds corny, good for America, good for democracy. I think they do believe in that. But they also know that they have these other competing pressures. So they are aware of these pressures, but they're fighting them. They don't always win.
Our guest, David Tewksbury, is Associate Professor in the Department of Communication here at U of I, where he's also Director of Graduate Study. We're talking about media, media bias, the forces that shape media, what it is we want from the news media. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. The next is in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Hi, David. Interesting program. I myself have turned to MSNBC recently, not for news and not too recently, but given the whole Bush fiasco, I had to give up on news. News was not telling us what we needed. We needed more commentary, and that's what I find that MSNBC provides. I trust my normal news outlets for news, but they really let me down over the past 8 years, and so sometimes I need some commentary to put it in perspective. Secondly, the news that I do watch on MSNBC, I don't really find a bias in, and I think it would be difficult to separate bias in regards to the campaign or so-called campaign that McCain tried to wage this past year. I mean, I thought it was honest reporting. I mean, it was an awful campaign, probably the worst there's ever been. And so I'm just curious why people think the coverage was biased. And that's just a comment. Thirdly, in regards to the campaign and the comments of the speaker about the tough situation that newspapers are in, I'm still wanting to cancel my News Gazette subscription. I've always trusted the News Gazette. But when they come out for John McCain like they did in this past campaign, I have to say, gosh, I don't really want to pay to support that point of view. I'm still carrying it because I think the local news is important, but it was, it took me aback that they could not separate their political ideology from the horrible campaign that this candidate ran, and so... Am I looking for something more objective than politics? I don't know. But those are three comments I just wanted to add. Thanks.
Well, thanks very much.
That's great. Let me talk a little bit about this, the comment I made earlier. I did it relatively unsubstantiated and much like a TV commentator. I just sort of threw out the charge of bias by MSNBC. I didn't really mean to say they were biased as much as to say they were really different than the average news broadcast. So let me give you an example. I brought a figure in here. you're looking at the, we looked at the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which is a funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. They did a content analysis of the campaign all the way through, including the primaries, and looking at the fall campaign, which is sort of the, you know, the traditional Labor Day to Election Day campaign. They looked at the tone of coverage of all the candidates, and there was this one little snippet that I noted this morning before coming in that MSNBC, they had 73% of their coverage or their stories about McCain were negative, whereas the average of all the cable news broadcasts was 53% were negative. So it's this kind of difference where you could say, well, they were a little more negative, a little more positive. Now, that doesn't say anything about what was right. You know, that's actually the key, is what's really impossible for us, you know, as observers or for the media, it's impossible to say what is true. And this is something that truth is, you know, is hard to ascertain. So what we can say is that they're different than the others, and they were more to the left than the others. Now, whether that was that left was correct or not is, I think, is almost entirely in the eye of the beholder. So I'll say that much to try to explain what I meant by that. And then, of course, the same, we have the opposite story for Fox coverage of McCain and Obama and so on. They were right of the others, of the rest of the news broadcast, both the cable and the broadcast networks. So there's that. Then I also want to mention a little bit about the News Gazette editorial. The great thing about being on the radio like this is I get to editorialize now too. But the key, I think, is newspapers have always been, always, and we're back to 1690, have always been apt to give their opinion. And I think that we as the audience need to think about whether we value their ability to give their opinion and their sort of their voice to give an opinion and how we put that in the context of their overall mission as a newspaper. So what I would say essentially is that from literally, I'll go back a little, do a little history lesson. 1690, the very first newspaper in America, public occurrences, both foreign and domestic, was a one-issue newspaper critical of the British government, and the guy and the publisher ended up in prison. And that's the start of the American newspaper. And American newspapering throughout the Revolutionary War period, really right up until about 1830, 1840, there were party presses, there were partisan presses, everything was entirely from the perspective of a particular political ideology. It's really a relatively recent phenomenon, 1880, 1890 through late 20th century, where we think of newspapers or all news as being this neutral, objective thing. But even during this period, the editorials themselves, newspapers held on to this sort of long-standing tradition of their sort of right, and it is protected by the First Amendment, but their right to say what they think. You know, their right to say, you know, I thought about what's going on in the news or what's going on in politics, and this is what we think. And I think, so it's a tradition. So I kind of want to tend to defend the tradition of doing editorial writing, and this is what newspapering is about. So right. There we go.
About 10 minutes left.
Not sure what to do with that, but anyway, I think we should not necessarily say
reflecting the opinions of this. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. I'll
give a disclaimer. Our guest is Dave Tewksbury. He's associate professor in the Department of Communication here at the University of Illinois. He's also director of graduate study. We're talking about media bias, what it is people are looking for in the media. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Belgium next, the community of Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to point out that perception is everything. Mr. Inge thinks fruitcake is tasty. I think it makes a passable doorstop.
Yes, that's right. You know, everybody's, I guess, entitled to their entitled to their opinion.
And in news, a few years back, they thought John Glenn going to space again was far more important than a horrible hurricane that hit Central America. Perception does seem to play the most important part of the whole thing, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, that's an excellent point.
Thank you very much.
Let me say a little more about perception, because that is really crucial, because one of the things that researchers have been looking at in my area, the political communication area, for the last 20 years is this something they call the hostile media perception or hostile media phenomenon. And this is that if you take two groups of people who are on different sides of an issue, and if you were to give them a news article, and it really doesn't matter what news article, but if you were to give them a news article that you did your level darn best to make as neutral and as balanced as possible, both of these partisan groups on both sides of some political issue will see it as biased against them. So, and this is, and you take a story which is overtly biased against one of the sides, or one side of this issue, and the other side will still see it as less biased than the other side. So there, it really is about perspective, and it really is about what your beliefs are going into it, how much you're attached to this issue, your sort of animosity toward the media, again, your trust or cynicism, or trust in the media. Perspective is everything.
So then, here, this gets me at the dangerous tendency that we have to make sweeping judgments or condemnations of the media for bias. And I suppose you have to acknowledge frequently that's coming from people who do have an ideological – they're in one ideological camp or another. Is it actually possible to give a neutral assessment of media bias? Is there some way that you can filter out your observer bias, whatever that person comes to it with, and then make some kind of objective conclusion about media? Do they tend to lean, one way or the other of the center?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this has been haunting researchers, people who work in the political communication field, because they think they can. But there's always, I think, in the back of their minds, they think they can distinguish, they can identify bias and count it and so on. Mm-hmm. But I think in the back of all of our minds is, but what if we can't? What if we're wrong? But what researchers will do, and researchers in political communication, just like this Project for Excellence in Journalism, will come up with systems for identifying positive and negative comments, for identifying amount of comments. They'll count paragraphs. They'll get down to the sentence level. They'll get down to the word level. They'll devise computer programs for identifying positivity and negativity in programs. They'll do in news articles. They'll do all this in an attempt to come up with as objective – I'll use that word – as accurate a means as possible. And then they test it. They make sure that anybody coming off the street could use that system to identify and get essentially the same reading they would as they would of the content of a news article. And so researchers go to great lengths to try to come up with what is plausibly a neutral or accurate depiction of the news. And then we say, okay, this is on the basis of this, we apply it to some news body or body of news, say the campaign coverage, and we say, here's how much negativity there was toward the president or toward this candidate. This is how much negativity there was toward this candidate. So they do try, but I think we're doing our best. But it's hard to know for sure that we haven't somehow let something slip in.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in line number one, and I think that would be in Effingham. Hello.
Yes. I'll make it short. The marriage of the U.S. news, both print and television, and their marriage to capitalism through advertising, mm-hmm. and the effects of that. And I'll hang up and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Well, that in sense, I suppose, goes back to what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. making the point that it's a business, and that there are some people who would really make the strong argument that, if commercial media has a bias, it's in favor, it leans in the direction of big industry, big mm-hmm. corporations, because, mm-hmm. well, they are big corporations.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it's not only the potential bias towards their sort of the corporate system or the corporations that they're behind, and we have lots and lots of examples mm-hmm. of news organizations, some of them anecdotal, some of them perhaps mere chance, but news organizations sort of producing news which is either not critical or in fact positive toward the organizations that they work for. But I think actually the bigger point that you make is actually support for the capitalist system. And there are folks, and there are a fair number of folks, researchers, who will say, yeah, that's actually probably the single largest underwriting bias of the news media, which is, or of all, almost all media, I should say, is that in order to be successful in business, the business system has to still exist. There has to be this capitalist system that's conducive to their survival. So they will essentially adopt a sort of a guard dog function to maintain the economic and political system, not political party, but political system status quo. And they'll protect that status quo over time. In not very conscious ways, but very sort of long-term, very systematic ways to protect it against criticisms that are sort of threatening to the political and economic status quo. I mean, that's essentially very in a kind of a short version. That's an argument that a lot of folks have made. You know, you can't pin it down to a news article. You can't say, oh, yeah, this guy is doing this because he's, you know, defending this, the capitalism. Well, it just doesn't work. But if you – people have argued that, if you look kind of look at the long view of how news operates and how really all media operate, advertising, everything operates to maintain the current system, that's kind of a no-brainer. That's sort of the way systems work. And so that's a very cogent argument. It's, I think, a very, very logical argument. But I don't know what to do with that.
All right. Well, thanks for the comment from the call. Let's go next and talk with someone in Loda. And this is line two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I think your explanation that you just made about the status quo is an excellent explanation of why the News Gazette editorial was written the way it was, which I thought was very poorly written, number one. And my assumption after reading it was just obligatory. I just didn't feel there was any real substance to it. But more importantly, my question relates to the Chicago Tribune's realignment, reorganization, particularly with their editorial page, which is hard to find now. I find that really, really perplexing. Do you have any observation about that?
That's a good question. I haven't seen the Tribune lately. I read it for one summer when I couldn't get the New York Times, and that was enough from the Chicago Tribune for me. I think that let's do this. Tell me more about what you're talking about. Tell me more about, you said, this realignment.
They reorganized the paper to make it easier to read, and but they moved the editorial pages from the front section to, I think, the business section, and it's really hard to find.
Yeah, within less than a year, they've done two radical redesigns of the paper, and I know I was really struck by the fact that the last one that they did was this past fall. And the first time I saw the paper, I didn't recognize that it was the Tribune. In fact, I walked by, I go to the same coffee shop every morning, and if I'm lucky that somebody has cast off the paper. And I know that for several days I walked by, and I don't know if I thought it was USA Today. I didn't even recognize it as the Tribune. Okay. And it took some getting used to, because there's more color, there's more graphic, they're putting big photos on the cover, and they've scrambled where in the paper stuff is. So it doesn't, it really does not look like what it used to. Myself, I think it's also maybe a little weaker on actual news content. I don't know. But clearly this is all about the paper's concerns about it surviving as a paper.
Oh, yeah. The Tribune Company is in big trouble. The Tribune Company large organization, which includes the New York, Los Angeles Times and a number of other papers, is in real trouble. And I think what you're probably reporting, or what you're probably observing them, is them saying, okay, what can we try now? All right, let's try something else. But I think that your point about the editorial, if they're moving it further back, you could read a strategy in there, a strategic comment, which is the one thing that editorials do is they either – two things, I should say. They either bore people, the people who are interested in them, or they make them angry. So one of the things they could be doing is they could be moving things further away from the front of the section if they didn't think that that's what their readers wanted to see. That's one guess. But I think the largest guess is that what you're observing about moving stuff around, bigger pictures, more graphics, this is the news business in the last 20 – the newspaper business in the last 20 years. So maybe they're just saying, gosh, let's find something that works.
Yeah. I don't know. Does it get at your comment?
Well, it seems to me that it also shows that they really don't value their opinions. Perhaps they're putting their opinions in their news. I don't know that, but I read a lot of editorials in different newspapers, and it seems to me that's a valuable part of a newspaper. And the Tribune is saying, well, it's not that valuable anymore.
I will say this. I think that editorials are very valuable, but I think to a relatively small subset of the audience. For example, I did one study once looking at what people read when they go online to read newspapers, things like the New York Times and USA Today and so on. And the number of folks who go to the editorials option, to actually read the editorials, is minute compared to the folks who will go to the sports coverage, the theater coverage, the politics coverage, the international coverage. So if we can look at what people actually go and read, editorials are relatively small today. So it could be that they know this, and yeah, they're saying, hey, people don't want to read about our opinion, and so they're just reacting to what they think is market pressure.
I appreciate the comment. Real quick, we got about a minute. My jaundiced view about people and what they're looking for in the media is confirmation, not to be challenged. Do we have some reason to think, well, either yes, that's true, or it's not true, that some people really do want to be challenged?
Yes, I think we actually do. I think that there's a subset of people who just want to see their beliefs in whatever genre, whatever the situation is, their beliefs about the Bears, you know, whatever. I mean, they want to see their beliefs reinforced, whatever the situation is. But I think there's a fair number of folks who come to things like politics or any of the current affairs issue with the view of, I want to find out what's real. I want to find out what's going on. But these are relatively stark differences, and they change by circumstance, but they change by the individual. But we should think about both of these sorts of people being in the audience.
Well, I want to thank you very much. David Tewksbury is our guest. He's Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Study in the Department of Communication here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. My apologies. We have one last person we just couldn't take, but we ended up out of time. Okay. I'm sure we can find some other things to talk about another day. Maybe we'll have you come back.
That'd be great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.